Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
There's a new book called The Science of Revenge, Understanding the World's Deadliest Addiction and How to Overcome It by a guy named James Kimmel.
Sounds interesting.
So his work presents the argument that revenge operates as a behavioral addiction akin to substance abuse. He delves into the brain's reward system, particularly dopamine, reinforcing the pursuit of revenge. And he posits that the compulsive desire for retribution is a primary driver of violence, you know, from personal conflicts to geopolitical aggression. And he's probably not wrong in saying that.
No, there's definitely a lot in that.
Yeah. Right. So, of course, there's good news.
I'm glad you always bring good news, Chris.
Understanding violence as addiction means we can treat it.
Okay.
Or not violence as addiction, revenge.
Revenge, yeah.
So, treating it beyond the means of the traditional means of arresting someone and punishing them, you can treat it with what?
Pharmaceuticals?
There you go.
Oh, God, what a guess.
So, they're talking about Ozempic and other, you know, addiction craving, other drugs that work on addiction cravings.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Question to you. What is it about everybody wanting a diagnosis for whatever faults they may have? Revenge is an emotion, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's more than an emotion. It also then becomes a passion, a decision. It's, you know, very closely tied to the anger and the thinking that you can bring about a restabilizing of justice in the universe by your action to get back at the person. I can definitely see how it becomes an addictive behavior. Anything that's related to anger, it's a strong passion. And all of our passions have the proclivity to, you know, turn into an addiction. There's no doubt about that. Now, about treating it with medicine, with some chemicals, again, I think you just go into the level of symptoms. You know, the way that our body works, these emotions release certain chemicals, and you can treat the symptomatic level of it, but are you dealing with the underlying issue? That issue is that you want to control things. Things are not working out your way. It's you're putting yourself at the center of the universe rather than God. It's not trusting in God. It's trusting in self.
Yeah, it's another way of saying the devil made me do it. Not yeah. My fault.
Or the dog ate my homework.
Yeah, you know, what did Adam say to Eve?
Mm-hmm.
Or what did Adam say to God? Right?
She made me do it. Yeah, she gave it to me.
It's as old as time.
Yeah, it was past the buck.
Another one that was in the news this past week was this recent trend of adults being diagnosed with autism. Like, this explains all my faults. I mean, autism absolutely exists, and autism in children being diagnosed, I don't have any problem with that. Why should I?
Mm-hmm.
But this notion of some 50-year-old explaining away the way that they are because they're autistic, I have a hard time believing you went through 50 years of life and, that's right, now I'm autistic.
Well, it can be for an easy form of escapism, just to pass the buck, blame it on something else. But the reality is we all have a certain degree of freedom as well to address, you know, flaws in our personality, weaknesses in our bad habits. And when we can offload that and offload the responsibility and make ourselves feel better about that, that can be a certain alleviation on the short term, but it doesn't address the underlying deeper issues that are in place.
Well, it's as though we're supposed to be born without faults. We all have faults.
We have original sin. You know, this is Catholic doctrine. We are born with original sin. This is proclivity towards sin, towards selfishness.
Concupiscence.
And, you know, when parents tell me, oh, my child is an angel, I say, no, your child is not an angel. Your child will make mistakes, they will sin, and they need to be guided and corrected, and they need to learn virtue. And all of us do. Even as we get older, you know, we can develop bad habits that need to be corralled.
Absolutely. And it's just a trend in society that no matter what it is, that it can be fixed with some counseling or, you know, medication, like we've talked about many times, instead of just saying, how about you take personal responsibility and control your emotions?
I think there's very a lot to that, Chris. But at the same time, we don't want to be dismissive of the value of proper medication.
No doubt.
You know, there's certain, you know, because of my medical history, I've got to take a couple of different medications, and they do help. I notice the difference. But when we start looking, not addressing underlying issues that can be addressed by personal decision, better habits, you know, a lot of doctors now are talking about food itself as medicine. If we have the discipline to eat healthy food, our bodies will be in a better place, and we don't have to take certain medications that are trying to address problems we've created by eating poorly.
Yeah, right. But if I make a decision that's a selfish decision, I don't want somebody down the road telling me that I got a drug to treat that. It's because I was being selfish.
Good point.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires. What is it about Latin? I'm sure you saw this decision by the Charlotte Diocese that effective in
Bishop
July,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's right.
That the Latin Mass will no longer be celebrated in parish churches within the diocese. Instead, it will be confined to a single chapel in Mooresville, North Carolina.
Yeah. Well, just a quick update on that. From what I've heard, the bishop actually rescinded his initial plan on that because of the uproar and the concern that people brought up from a pastoral standpoint. So he's kind of put on hold that decision.
All right. So regardless of whether he has put it on hold or not, there is this trend, right? Pope Francis himself had addressed.
Interventiones custodes, yeah.
Right. So I myself have been to many a Latin service and have appreciated what I perceive as the, you know, increased reverence that seems to exist around. But, and I get why, you know, because of Vatican II, or one of the reasons Vatican II, one of the decisions rather that came out of Vatican II was the, you know, participating in the Mass in the vernacular versus in Latin. And it makes it more approachable and relatable.
Well, I think we need to be clear. Let's go to the actual documents of Vatican II, and it actually stipulates that the Mass can be celebrated in the vernacular, but also advocating for retention of certain parts of the Mass in Latin because of the beauty of the liturgy and all of the Gregorian chant which surrounds them.
Right. So they opened up the possibility of the vernacular.
Correct.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't.
It wasn't mandated that you
preclude
had
Latin.
Exactly.
Right. So, but I get why you want to open up the vernacular, making, you know, everything a little more relatable.
Well, it makes it a lot easier to follow the Mass.
Sure.
I mean, it's because if you can understand it in your own language, you don't have to look at a missal.
Right. You're right. We went to a church in Houston, downtown Houston, that did the full Mass in Latin that you had to read along. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I said, it was very reverent, but it was also, you know, I was less engaged because I'm reading along, not, you know, I'm reading and thinking about it.
Were you? I mean, I've found like in Mass in English, when I use a missal and follow along, even though I know all the responses, I'm actually more engaged because I'm less likely to get distracted or daydream. And I think some people have found that whether it's, you know, you using a missal in an English language Mass or whatever your native language is, or in a Latin Mass, there does tend to be a little bit more focus.
So where I'm going with this is there something special about the language of Latin? Mm-hmm. So in media, traditionally, and in movies, when there's an exorcism or, right, the devil is typically depicted as speaking in Latin, and that's how they know there's some possession.
Oftentimes, it's not just Latin, but also in Greek and other Aramaic or Syriac,
right,
the devil will use other ancient languages.
Right. So the question to you is there something about the language of Latin now?
Well, there is. There certainly is, because Latin is still the official language of the church. Many of the most important documents in the Vatican are published first in Latin, or their official version of the document is published in Latin. And there's a reason for that. Like in my religious order, the Legionaries of Christ, Spanish is our official language. And the reason for that is so that we have a unicity and we can communicate with each other across the world. So even in the Vatican today, I mean, I spent 8 years studying in Rome, all the main liturgies would be in Latin. Sometimes it'd be in Italian. sometimes would have a reading in English or Spanish or some other language. But generally, the language is Latin, so that people coming from anywhere in the world could find a commonality in having the Mass in Latin. Now, I think a lot of times there's a confusion on this because there's what we call the TLM, the traditional Latin Mass, which is using the Missal from 1962. And then there's Novus Ordo in Latin as well. I celebrate Mass oftentimes in the Novus Ordo in Latin on a daily basis. I'm very fluent in Latin. I don't have any difficulty with it. I love it. It's a beautiful language. I think, though, what happens sometimes, Chris, is people begin to attribute an almost magical quality to Latin.
And that's exactly what I'm getting at.
That's so problematic.
Okay, so it's believed that supernatural entities like angels and demons respond to sacred authority, and Latin is seen as the language of spiritual power and formality. Is there something
to that?
There's
a reason for that, because the rite for exorcism is in Latin, and there are translations of it, but primarily it is utilized in Latin.
So what you're saying is if it was all in Greek, then it would be no different. If the official language of the church were Greek, all of these same things would still be, there's not something special about Latin.
It's the power of Christ coming through the authority of the church gives Latin a special relevance. And if the church were to decide tomorrow that English is now the official language of the church and changed all the rites into to English, the demons would obey that.
Right. So you're saying there's nothing special about Latin. It's just that that's the official language of the church.
In a temporal manner, yes, it is. It is significant because it is the official language of the church. Otherwise, Latin has no magical quality. Sometimes people think that, well, Latin is never changes. That's not true. You can read the breviary from something from St. Augustine compared against the Latin of St. Thomas Aquinas, and it's totally different. It's like speaking Shakespearean English or, you know,
right,
English on the streets in the Bronx.
Right.
You almost can't even understand the difference. And that's what happens in Latin, too. It was a living language for hundreds and hundreds of years. And because of that, there's a great variety in the Latin down through the ages. So people who attribute a magical quality to Latin, I think they're a little bit off base historically and theologically. But at the same time, I think we have to avoid, sometimes we see this on the opposite side of the spectrum, where people are looking upon Latin as something that's hung up in the past and it's bad and it's taking us away from Christ. And I think that's silly. And it's also, in the same way, just not respecting history.
As I said, when I have experienced the Latin Mass, it just feels more reverent.
And my experience is the opposite. I've been to a number of Latin Masses where it wasn't particularly reverent. I remember I had to preach a parish mission at a parish where they were having the mass, traditional Latin Mass. So I went in choir and I had to go give the homily. And people were kind of distracted during the Mass, and it wasn't entirely reverent. I went up to give the homily and I started speaking the homily in Latin, and I got a lot of blank stares from people. So I switched into English because I think that it can go either way. I've seen Latin Masses that are beautiful, very, very reverent. And I've seen English Masses, which are very beautiful and reverent. So much comes back on how does the priest draw people into worship of God? And that's at the core of the matter here, Chris. Are we truly worshiping God in what we're doing?
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires. I read this New Yorker article reporting that Johns Hopkins University and NYU have conducted formal trials giving magic mushrooms and or ayahuasca to religious leaders. Including in this.
Sorry, Chris. I just can't help but laugh at that
right,
one.
So in this formal study that they conducted, they had a Baptist Bible scholar, several rabbis, an Islamic leader, a Zen Buddhist, and unfortunately, in my mind, a Catholic priest.
Mm.
So they were studying the connection between psychedelic drugs and religious experiences, building on earlier research showing that things like magic mushrooms can cause these mystical type experiences.
Very interesting.
And so I get that most of us are seeking a mystical encounter with God, but I also get that maybe it's not something that we shouldn't necessarily hope for that, that we may be glad we don't see what's invisible. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about when I read the writings of St. Catherine of Siena and her intense mystical experiences, mm-hmm. Her visions of angels and demons. So she reported that her experiences were so intense and so realistic that she believed if ordinary people experienced this, they would literally die of fright.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thoughts?
Well, several thoughts come to mind, Chris. First, it's a very interesting topic. Secondly, though, there, all throughout the history of the church, when the fathers of the church, the mystics, talk about their mystical experiences, their recommendation is not to seek those things out. That what we should be seeking is just union with God, loving God in the ordinary and the simple. And I think a desire to chase after that type of mystical experience, in my own experience as a priest, anytime I've come across people that are actively seeking that, it's usually not a good sign.
But
in fact, I've never seen it when it has been a good sign.
You could see an attraction for somebody saying they want to be able to see their guardian angel.
Not really. I guess I don't see an attraction for it.
But you would know that they're there, right? Even though they are there. I could see that's...
Blessed are those who believe without seeing.
Sure.
It's just, why do we need to see? Sometimes we can have that this human desire to want to have some sort of a confirmation of what we believe, what we don't see, and what we don't perceive with our senses. It could be like with the Eucharist. Oh, I want to be able to taste the blood of Jesus or something. Okay, that could be.
But come on, you would be thrilled to be there for a Eucharistic miracle, wouldn't you?
I mean, after the fact, yeah, it'd be cool to have been part of something like that where God really showed his presence. But I've already been there. I've been in moments when God has acted in this situation. I've been in the midst of miracles, and it hasn't made my life a cakewalk afterwards.
No, I know. And I
it doesn't take away the challenges that you have to faith even after the fact. I mean, you look at the Israelites who experienced the crossing of the Red Sea.
Absolutely.
They still wandered away from God.
Absolutely. And what I'm saying is that I can see the attraction. I'm not, and
sure.
I have certainly experienced God's miracles many times in my life, and I'm, and it's without seeing anything more than we are naturally able to see, but I can see the attraction. But I think this seeking using these psychedelics is absolutely atrocious. And so, Aaron Rodgers.
It's dangerous.
Have you heard about his whole experiences with ayahuasca?
No.
So, he goes after, I don't know when he started this, but he's been multiple times down to Peru during the off season to do these ayahuasca
retreats,
let's call them. And he's talked about since then, he sees, even during football games, this, what he calls the Hat Man, this dark shadowy figure off in the distance. And he's holding a corpse of a dead rabbit and sometimes a blade.
Mm.
And I'm like, that right there would be why I don't want to take ayahuasca. I don't want to be seeing the Hat Man.
No. And when you get into those kind of things, you're crossing over into the spiritual realm in ways that are dangerous. You talk with any exorcist and he says, don't mess around with those kind of things.
Right. I have a buddy that went down. He was experiencing, chronic fatigue syndrome or something like that for many, many years. And he went down as a last resort to do one of these ayahuasca things. And what he told me, I was like, okay, thank you for telling me that, because I'm going to make sure that nobody I ever know does what you did. He's talking about for months afterwards, he'd have rocks that were talking to him. I'm like, okay, I don't
That's
want rocks
weird.
Talking to me.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that definitely does not sound good.
Well, I was don't disappointed to hear that there was a Catholic priest involved in this study. That's that's what piqued my interest in it.
Well, there's the whole spectrum of Catholic priests. We need to pray for them all.
Right.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires.
Catholic commentator George Weigel has a recent essay critiquing the prevailing academic attitude that denies the existence of objective truths, labeling it as radical skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
He references a former Harvard president's 2007 university address where she suggested that truth is not a possession, but an aspiration, and that there should be a commitment to perpetual doubt. So obviously he argues that this mindset results in nihilism and moral relativism. And he emphasizes the traditional Catholic university model that operates from the premise that certain fundamental truths exist and can be discovered through reason, revelation, and tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So, as an example, he brings up the inherent beauty of Michelangelo's Pietà or the moral wrongness of child abuse. Their universe, child abuse should be, or hopefully it is, universally recognized as wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's therefore part of the natural law. So the perpetual doubt approach, which seems to be the prevailing climate in academia, does have some positives in that it can, you know, protect against this dogmatism, and it can encourage genuine inquiry, right?
Certainly can, but it can also be a mask for pride. And I think that's the real problem when you get into radical skepticism, is that you are subjecting everything to your own mind. There is no longer any trust. And when you cannot trust anyone else but yourself, it's a very lonely world. It's a world devoid of God. And that's why I think in his encyclical letter, my favorite encyclical actually of any of the popes is from Pope Benedict XVI, Spes Salvi. He talks about what are the effects of a world like that where you can't trust anyone, you doubt everything. It's despair. And what this whole mindset brings across is a world without God, because God is truth. God is goodness. God is beauty. And when you begin to deny the possibility of attaining to truth, you're denying the possibility of God. And it becomes a very empty and lonely world.
Absolutely. And we see this progressing in recent decades with things like the denial of the existence of two genders.
Mm-hmm.
Even what we would...
But at the same time, it's been replaced with a belief.
Right.
And that's the thing that people don't oftentimes recognize. There's a radical belief that, you know, in certain principles which are contrary to reality. So it's rather bizarre, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, we posit that child abuse is universally accepted as wrong. Yet, you know, there's these terms now that pedophilia is, they're not pedophilia acts, they're younger attracted. There's some term that's associated, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, it's sort of like opening the door to this being a thing that's possibly not wrong.
Right. And there's that strong push, the NAMBLA, is the North American Man-Boy Love Association, which has pushed for things like that and decriminalization of sexual abuse or predatory behavior towards minors. It's just, it's really sick.
Yeah. And so this is, here's where I find it kind of interesting, is that we all agree that 2 + 2 = 4, right?
Are you sure?
That's what, right?
I would agree with that. Yeah, sure. Yeah, so, I'll concede you that one, Chris.
But your question, are you sure, is I think a prescient one, because in recent time, Newtonian physics, we all accept Newtonian physics as fact and as provable, just the same way that 2 + 2 is provable, yet quantum mechanics disproves almost every tenet of Newtonian physics. And so 2 + 2 doesn't always equal 4.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess where I'm going with that is we tend to only say objective truths are ones that are provable, but, you know, we have to accept that there are certain moral and legal principles that exist independent of human convention.
Do we have to? I mean, I think this is the key point that people would get to. Do we have to accept that? Because they feel that that's a constriction of their freedom. That they're no longer free, or they no longer have options. So certain personalities tend towards that rejection of any type of stricture. And so they get uncomfortable if you say there's a truth. I think that's just infantile. It's a rather adolescent mindset. You know, when you're a teenager, you rebel against everything your parents say, even if it makes a lot of sense. You don't want to admit that it makes sense. And I think there's a progression in human thought where we can arrive to a greater maturity, where we can recognize there is a givenness to the world. There's a something that we have to accept and realize there are parameters.
And those parameters are freeing.
Instead of encumbering, they're freeing. Exactly. That's what every convert to Catholicism has ever experienced. From the outside looking in, they say, oh, these rules and things that Catholics have to do and they can't do that. But once you become part of that and you accept that you are part of something bigger than yourself, and this is God who loves me, then there's a tremendous freedom that comes from that.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Researchers have recently unraveled the mystery behind a centuries-old, quote, mummified dragon housed in Japan.
Okay.
Originally discovered in the year 1429 by some Japanese shogun during a visit to a temple, the skeleton was long believed to be this mythical creature. Recent analysis using various X-ray and radiocarbon techniques have identified the thing as a Japanese marten, which is like a ferret-looking thing.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So whenever there's dragons mentioned in the news or you see depictions of them in movies like Lord of the Rings, I'm always fascinated by the fact that the Bible makes multiple references to this creature that's mythical. Mm-hmm. And it's the only mythical creature mentioned in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Why? What is it about dragons? Do dragons actually exist?
Well, remember that any word that we have in English that's translated as dragon could be some other word in its original language that we may not understand fully. And there, we know there's been extinction of lots of different species. So it's entirely possible that there was a, you know, a large lizard-like creature in a certain
area. But
fire-breathing?
That
killed out. Well, there's, you know, there's some talk that talks about the Komodo dragon that mm-hmm. will actually put out a kind of a growling sound. I'm not an expert in dragons, but it's certainly interesting to look at that. And,
yeah,
and
right. It's the only. It's not like we're talking about minotaurs in the Bible. We're only talking about dragons.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think it's interesting that, you know, obviously this dragon that this guy talked about.
Yeah, and there's lots of creatures that look somewhat similar to creatures of like dragons. I mean, you know, crocodiles and alligators.
Right. Could it be that dragons are just some allegory for evil?
It could be. I think it'd be interesting to do an exegetical study on where do dragons appear in scripture. It's not very often.
Not very often, but it's in literature over the, you know, centuries mm-hmm. constantly.
Yeah, St. George killed the dragon, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So is it like the snakes in Ireland? Is it just some, you know?
I don't know. There's a fascination that human beings have with dragons. So it'd be interesting to
and it's specific
dig
to dragons.
Into a little bit more.
Yeah.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.